Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, October 17, 2013, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing federal diversity jurisdiction. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome back to today's call our returning expert, Chuck Cooper, and his partner, Howard Nielsen. They are both litigators and partners at the D.C. law firm Cooper & Kirk. We're going to hear opening remarks from Mr. Cooper of about 8 to 12 minutes or so, and then we'll have a little discussion, and then both will take questions from the audience. So please be ready with your questions. And with that, Mr. Cooper, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Dean. I appreciate very much your hosting this call and gathering our participants to discuss the diversity jurisdiction of the federal courts, and more specifically and particularly, the case pending before the United States Supreme Court, captioned State of Mississippi X. Rel. Hood against AU Optronics Corporation. That case is one in which our firm and specifically Howard Nielsen and I have authored an amicus brief on behalf of the Access to Courts Initiative Incorporated and the National Association of Manufacturers. And some background about the issues in the case itself. This was a case brought by the Attorney General of the State of Mississippi in the state's own name, and exclusively in the state's own name as a parens patriae suit, against a number of out-of-state manufacturers of liquid crystal displays, that is the LCD panels that appear in most devices today. The case alleged that the defendants had engaged in price fixing in violation of the state's own laws, its own specifically own Antitrust Act and its Consumer Protection Act. And these types of cases are pending in jurisdictions all over the country, antitrust suits against these particular defendants. Many have been brought under federal and state antitrust laws. But a few, like the state of Mississippi, has been brought exclusively under state statutes in state courts. I think there's at least four or five other cases in addition to this Mississippi case that have been brought exclusively under state law in state court. Not surprisingly, the defendants in the case preferred to litigate this case in federal court. And they sought to remove it under the authority of the Class Action Fairness Act. And that statute vests jurisdiction in the federal district courts over certain large class actions and mass action cases. For purposes of this case, however, it's the mass action provision that is relevant. The mass actions are defined under CAFA as civil damage actions in which the damages claims of 100 or more persons are proposed to be tried jointly on the ground that the plaintiff's claims involve common questions of law or fact and that the amount in controversy exceeds $75,000. Anything falling within that criteria is determined under CAFA to be a class action that can be brought in federal district court, or if not brought in federal district court, can be removed by the defendants to federal district court. In this particular case, the decisive question, according to the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, was whether the suit involves claims by 100 or more persons, notwithstanding the fact that the suit was brought in the name of only one litigant, only one plaintiff, that is the state of Mississippi itself. The court, the three-judge panel, relied on an earlier case as binding called Caldwell against Allstate Insurance Company. And in that case, the Fifth Circuit determined that it must pierce the pleadings, as it put it, in these types of actions and look at each claim asserted in the complaint to determine whether or not the real parties in interest with respect to each such claim, who they are and how numerous they are. If there's more than 100 real parties in interest in such a claim, even if it's brought in the state's name, then it, according to the Caldwell case, would qualify as a mass action. So in that process, which the court calls the claim by claim approach to analyzing an action like this, the court determined that the state's claim for restitutionary relief was made on behalf not only of the state as a consumer of LCD panels itself, but also on behalf of the individual citizens of Mississippi who had purchased LCDs within the state as well. And given that the real parties in interest, as analyzed from that standpoint, far exceeded 100 individuals, the Fifth Circuit held that the action was a mass action within the meaning of the Class Action Fairness Act, and therefore was within federal district court jurisdiction and could be removed to federal court. Now, Judge Elrod filed a concurring opinion, but it was concurring only because she, too, believed that the panel was bound by its earlier decision in the Caldwell case. She was quite explicit that she thought that had been wrongly decided, and that she agreed with the dissenting opinion in Caldwell, which was written by Judge Southwick, that the court had misanalyzed the Class Action Fairness Act and misinterpreted it. She among the things she relied upon, and she placed a great deal of reliance on it, was the interpretive canon that removal statutes generally should be strictly construed. And more particularly, she said that especially in a case brought by a state, they should be strictly construed. And this is what she said. The rule should apply with particular force when the plaintiff is a state that sued in its own courts. Removing such a case to federal court implicates important principles of federalism, and here she's quoting from a Supreme Court case, and quote, considerations of comity should make us reluctant to snatch cases which a state has brought from the courts of that state unless some clear rule demands it, end quote. Now, there have been, and Judge Elrod pointed out that three other courts of appeals have gone the other way. They have held that a case such as this should be analyzed in terms of the entire complaint, not on a claim-by-claim basis, but rather viewed from the standpoint of the entire complaint and who the real party in interest is with respect to the action as a whole. And from that standpoint, all three of the other courts of appeals have held that these types of actions, parens patriae actions by states brought in their own state courts under state law, are not mass actions and therefore are not removable. And every one of those cases as well relied upon this generic doctrine that removal statutes should be strictly construed, particularly in the context of a state litigant. Our amicus brief is narrowly targeted at that interpretive canon, that notion which is long prevailed in the federal courts and is particularly, and the federal courts seem particularly fond of it, I think for obvious institutional reasons. But that interpretive canon is the target of our amicus brief. The bottom line point of our brief is that canon is really entirely at odds with the language and with the specific purpose of Article 3, and in particular, the diversity clauses of Article 3, Section 2. And just the basic thrust of our amicus brief is this. Article 3, Section 2 uses mandatory language. It mandates that, and I'm quoting now, the judicial power shall extend to, among other things, controversies between two or more states, between a state and citizens of another state, between citizens of different states. But obviously, the language between a state and citizens of another state is precisely the case that on the face of the pleadings in this case, the court had before it. So, but whether this case is viewed as a parens patriae action on behalf of the state alone, or as an action on behalf of a host of Mississippi citizens as the real parties in interest, it's indisputably either one or the other. That is, it's either a controversy between a state and citizens of another state, or a controversy between citizens of different states. And so it's therefore squarely within the clear text of Article 3, providing that the judicial power of the United States shall extend to just such controversies. And as Justice Story made clear in his landmark decision opinion in Martin against Hunter's lessee, these jurisdictional provisions of Article 3 are not for plaintiffs only. As he put it, they were not intended, quote, to be exercised exclusively for the benefit of parties who might be plaintiffs and would elect the national forum, but also for the protection of defendants who might be entitled to try their rights or assert their privileges before the same forum. The other important fact that weighs against this this interpretive canon that the federal courts invoke essentially to place a thumb on the scale against removal in diversity cases especially, is that the very essence, the very reason, existential purpose of the diversity clauses was to provide a federal tribunal for these, precisely these kinds of cases, those that are brought by a state or its citizens against citizens of other states. And it expressly brings those within the jurisdiction of federal courts because, in the words of Hamilton in Federalist number 80, they're the tribunals which, having no local attachments, will likely be impartial between different states and their citizens. And that was really the whole point of the diversity clauses. They were designed to ensure, particularly in light of the necessity for having impartial tribunals to litigate and adjudicate interstate disputes. And therefore to promote the kind of confidence that is necessary for dispute resolution among parties involved in interstate commerce, that's the existential purpose of the diversity clauses. And in light of the language and those purposes, our simple point to the court is that however the court approaches interpreting the mass action provision of the Class Action Fairness Act, it should do so without any thumb on the scale against removal, and if anything, with a thumb on the scale in favor of removal in light of the plain language and purpose of those diversity clauses. And so with that background, let me ask Dean, if I may. Let me ask Howard Nielsen if there's anything that I've left out that should be noted, or if I've made any mistakes that you need to correct.
No, this is Howard. I thought that was a very good summary of both the specific case and the points made in our amicus brief. I think one thing that perhaps bears even more emphasis that I think you covered is that the purpose of the diversity clauses was very much to take this basically dysfunctional Confederacy that had existed since the Declaration of Independence, and to break down the parochial barriers between the states and knit the states into a single economic unit where people could with confidence cross state lines, they could invest across state lines with confidence that their disputes, if they came up, their interstate disputes, could be tried in a forum that would be impartial and that would not be inclined to favor the citizens of one state versus another. And so just as the Constitution gave Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce, just as it had guaranteed the citizens of all the states the privileges and immunities of citizens in other states, the diversity clauses were very much a part and parcel of that attempt to take these divided states and make a united economic union and nation out of them.
Yeah, and I might even add to those provisions you've cited, Howard, the contract clause, which disabled states from invalidating contracts, the obligation of contracts, which was very important as well in that regard, and was oftentimes cited hand in hand with the diversity clauses establishing federal jurisdiction over interstate disputes. So, with that, Dean, perhaps it would be well to open it up to questions and comments.
Well, terrific. Thank you very much. In case you joined us late, we obviously have Chuck Cooper on the phone with us. He's joined by his partner, Howard Nielsen, who wasn't in our announcement but has agreed to join the call and participate in the opening remarks and in taking questions. So with that, let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see who rings in here with a question, let me just make a brief programming announcement. Our schedule is, as always, somewhat in flux, but we do have a call scheduled for next Wednesday. That's October 23rd. That's our next scheduled call as of right now. That's with FTC Maureen Olhausen, who's going to host a call and give us some sense of her agenda for the Federal Trade Commission going forward. Once again, if you have a question for Chuck Cooper or Howard Nielsen, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, I think it may be me. It's Tom Graves at the American Coatings Association's good rendition. I want to ask you guys a question of whether you thought the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the Constitution also might be further support for your argument.
Tom, thanks for that question. It is indeed it's support at least at the level of generality that Howard referenced it earlier in the sense that the framers were really quite focused in a variety of different ways on ensuring a national commercial marketplace and on attempting to address and try to neutralize, if not eliminate, what they knew to be the impediments to creating and fostering a national commercial marketplace. That the states had would naturally throw up, and the kind of provisions such as the contract clause, the provision prohibiting states from issuing tender, the interstate commerce clause itself, and the diversity jurisdiction clauses were part and parcel of that, as was the determination to ensure that all citizens have the same privileges and immunities of citizenship, national citizenship that were available to all others. So yes, it's part of the mosaic, really, that that the diversity clauses fit snugly into, and that at least in our view, having read not just the plain language of Article 3, but deeply into the convention records and the ratification debates, make quite plain the purpose that was of a piece with these other provisions to ensure that those who engaged in this hopefully national interstate market could do so with the confidence that their disputes, which obviously would be inevitable, that their disputes would be resolved, or at least there would be a forum available to them that was national in character, rather than the possibility of the home cooking that either in reality or in perception could be available in state court.
Thank you,
Mr. Nielsen. Do you want to weigh in here, or should we go to the next caller?
Let's go to the next call.
Okay. Well, before we do that, I'm going to ask a question for Chuck Cooper, if I could. Your argument, as usual, is extremely compelling. I'm left wondering, what's the argument on the other side? I mean, you do present the mosaic, I think, very very strongly. It just seems to make sense to me that, given the way our country was knit together, to borrow Howard's phrase, that this makes perfect sense. What is the argument on the other side?
Well, I will say that the arguments that have been advanced against Story's view for mandatory diversity jurisdiction have been rather perfunctory, at least the ones that have been developed in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. The initial decision, which basically implicitly held that Congress has plenary authority either to grant or to withhold jurisdiction over diversity cases from federal courts, was decided in a case, I think it was the Turner case, in the early 1800s. The argument was made by the litigants there that Congress didn't have power to condition diversity jurisdiction in a case where one citizen, or at least citizens from different states, are on either side of the V in a dispute, and the court simply rejected it implicitly. And there's an interesting footnote in that case, which contains a statement made by one of the justices at the oral argument in the case, which simply says, it is for Congress to dispose of our jurisdiction. We have it only to the extent that it is granted to us by Congress. That strange footnote was ultimately adopted as the holding of the court in a case, many decades later. But the Supreme Court has never really come to grips with a very satisfying analytical response to Story, at least certainly nothing that I believe Howard has found satisfying.
Okay, Howard. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button. Mr. Nielsen, did you have a comment here?
Just briefly, that was a very good summary, I think. I mean, just to, it really is, the contrary argument is based on longstanding precedents that are not particularly well-reasoned, that don't really address the text of Article 3 or its purposes. And, this footnote comment from oral argument that sort of has become the genesis of this position that Congress has plenary authority, in terms of purports to speak the political truth, You know, it just says the political truth is that the disposal of the judicial power belongs to Congress. So that's essentially the position the court's taken. I don't know what it meant by the political truth. Maybe it was, maybe the court was claiming an institutional inability to stand up to Congress. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got one caller on the line, and then our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button if you'd like to join the queue. Let's go to our next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. I agree with your reading of Article 3. However, it would seem to run up against the 1923 decision in Massachusetts v. Mellon, which denied standing to states to appear on behalf of their citizens in parens patriae. And if that this precedent is not overturned, it would seem that states are without recourse to defend the rights of their citizens against parties out of state, except perhaps by subsidizing their attorney fees. What do you think of that?
I'm not sure. So you're saying that states are unable in federal court
Represent their citizens. That was a holding in Massachusetts v. Mellon, 1923.
Okay. Yeah.
It was
Howard, do you have
a
I do you
companion.
have a
It was combined with Frothingham v. Mellon, two different cases consolidated with similar holdings, although in this case concerned parens patriae.
Yes, I could speak to that if you'd like, Chuck.
Please.
The way I understand Massachusetts versus Mellon, if I recall correctly, it was essentially a federalism challenge. There was a companion challenge brought by, as you mentioned, the Frothingham decision, case brought by citizens challenging the constitutionality of a federal law, and then a suit brought by Massachusetts challenging the constitutionality of a federal law on the grounds that it exceeded the federal government's enumerated powers and violated the 10th Amendment. And the way I understand Massachusetts versus Mellon is it didn't say outright that states can't assert parens patriae interests in federal court. It said that with respect to federal issues, including federalism apparently, it was the federal government and not the state government that was the proper party to assert those parens patriae interests. So vis-a-vis the relationship of the citizens and the federal government, you know, they basically said the state couldn't step in and represent that sort of parens patriae claim. And later cases have made clear that where the state is asserting other types of interests on behalf of its citizens, interests arising as in the AU Aptromik case out of state law, then the state can step in and assert those rights as parens patriae. So basically, Massachusetts and Mellons holds that when you're asserting rights based on national law, including the Constitution, it's the federal government and not the state government that can assert those interests, parens patriae.
Very good. We've got nobody on the line right now with a question. Let me make a final call for questions here and see if we can keep the discussion going. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. If not, Chuck, let me give you an opportunity and you as well, Howard Nielsen, to make any final comments or wrap up, make a final point if you'd like to.
Well, thank you, Dean. I'm happy to. And again, I want to express my gratitude to you and the Federalist Society for hosting this teleconference. We appreciate it very much. I would only say.
Chuck, it's Dean. I'm sorry if I could interrupt you. There's somebody now that has rung in with a call. Can we take another question?
Sure.
Okay, hold on.
Yes, hello. I really don't have a question because you're a bit beyond my capacity to understand it all. but I taught in high school and have a master's in political science and never really understood diversity cases. And your explanation has been an eye-opener and an excellent explanation of it. And I very much appreciate the opportunity to listen in and hear that explanation. So thank you very much. I do have perhaps one question. I've often heard it said that the Constitution does not contemplate the type of economy we ought to have, whether it be capitalist, free market, socialist, and whatnot. Is there anything that would imply that it did, in fact, contemplate something of a free market capitalist type of system and preclude the possibility of a nationalistic, state-controlled command economy type of system?
Well, I think it's, at least to my mind, and I appreciate the caller's question very much and appreciate your dialing into our discussion today. But I think it's, to my mind, it's very hard to read the protections in the Constitution, particularly the protections that relate to commerce and those engaged in commerce, and as that we've already discussed here, coupled with the protections that were added immediately after the Constitution itself was ratified in the Bill of Rights, that protect property in particular, and ensure that individuals have the freedom to accumulate property and wealth, and that accumulated wealth cannot be confiscated and without a just compensation, cannot be taken without just compensation. Protections that throughout the Constitution make, I believe, quite clear that there are certain types of economic systems that are not possible, at least at the national level. It's a whole lot less clear whether or not states and how they can organize themselves in terms of their political relations and their economic decisions, except to the extent that states obviously are limited in what they can and cannot do vis-a-vis interstate commerce and others who would come into within their states and engage in commercial transactions. But about the only particular political protection is the guarantee clause of a Republican form of government within the states. But Howard, do you have anything to add to that kind of rambling off the cuff reaction?
No, I think that was very good. Well, let me say this. I think, you know, subject, the Constitution does give Congress a fair amount of discretion, I suppose, subject to the safeguards protecting property from being taken and so forth that Chuck mentioned, and also subject to the fact that, you know, clearly the Constitution contemplated a national economy, not a economy that would be broken up into regions or state by state. So, you know, there is some discretion for Congress to be sure, but there are constraints, and you know, both with respect to individual property and with respect to you know, these attempts that we've been discussing to ensure a national economy.
Thank you. I think that that's very much appreciated and in line with my thoughts as well. And it seems to me that the national constitution contemplated not only about political liberty but also economic liberty and all sorts of individual freedoms, which are difficult to justify if you have an economy that's totally run and controlled by the state, because the necessity for forcing people to do things they'd rather not do is certainly there. The Constitution itself, therefore, can only be interpreted, or at least it seems to me, if you are predisposed to understand the classical liberalism behind it, which was the promotion of individual freedom. So I thank you.
Thank you very much.
It looks like we are resuming the Q&A portion of our discussion here with one question pending. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, thank you all for doing this. I came in a little late, so I may have missed this, but is it your position that individuals, citizens have a constitutional right to having diversity jurisdiction and that Congress can impose the limits such as the $75,000, amount in controversy requirement or, the requirement of complete diversity jurisdiction and things like that?
Yeah. I think that's a very good question, and I will say that at least insofar as, say, complete diversity is concerned versus minimal diversity, and as the caller undoubtedly knows and for others who are listening, the Supreme Court has interpreted the diversity statute to require complete diversity such that every plaintiff must be diverse from every defendant in terms of their state citizenship. That decision was actually handed down in a six-sentence opinion written by a Chief Justice Marshall in the early 1800s without any serious analysis, and remarkably was later determined by the court to have been wrongly decided in dicta. The court has never actually reversed that requirement of complete diversity, so it continues to control to this day. My own view, having reviewed the not just the language but the history of the convention and the ratification, is that Justice Story really hasn't been answered in terms of his interpretation of Article III as being mandatory in nature, and that to the extent at least of minimal diversity versus complete diversity, I do think that the court its decision interpreting the statute actually violates the requirements of the diversity clause. Whether or not other limitations would likewise be would be unconstitutional may raise different questions. The jurisdictional amount that you just mentioned. I can see, and neither I nor Howard has really dug into that seemingly very tough question to have come to a conclusion on it. But we do think that it would raise different questions. It's not at all clear that Congress the framers intended in vesting diversity jurisdiction in federal courts, intended them to have no control whatsoever over the size of the case that could qualify for federal jurisdiction. That question would implicate a number of things, including the clear intent of the founding generation that these diversity clauses were for cases that would implicate the national peace and harmony, as Randolph and Madison put it in some of those early debates. It's hard to imagine that a very small, insignificant, inconsequential case, even if it fell technically within the diversity jurisdiction, was not something that the courts or Congress could not set limits to prevent. But it is a tough question, and it's not one, that particular one is not one that we've dug in on and come to any decision on. So consider that a dodge of that very difficult question.
Howard Nielsen, do you have a comment here?
No, yes, I'll just say briefly, I think Chuck got it, you know, explained it very well. In this context, where there's so much water under the bridge, I think it's important to distinguish, you know, are we saying as a matter of first principles based on the text and original understanding? If that's the criterion alone, then it's very difficult indeed to square the requirement of complete diversity with the Constitution. And so the question becomes, how much weight do you give to subsequent precedent and things of that nature? And, you know, in any event, I believe our position would be if, you know, whether, you know, regardless of whether the court's willing to back up and correct its longstanding but probably erroneous view of the Constitution, you know, we believe it shouldn't compound the damage by, for example, putting a thumb on the scale against federal jurisdiction when it interprets statutes and so forth.
Yeah, let me just add here, Dean, that I appreciate Howard's important point. I was my answer did assume that the question asked for a view of what the original meaning of the diversity clauses was, as opposed to what the prospects were for the court to re-examine that view in light of all the precedent over essentially two centuries that has taken place.
We've got one more caller with a question at this point. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Excuse me. Let's take another audience question here.
John Rowland, Constitution.org back. If we were to strictly apply complete diversity rule, then a state could always avoid removal by throwing in a defendant who was in state as a straw man, yeah, unless removal contemplated doing a separation of cases into those out of state and those in state. So we have a policy there if that rule were to allow to stand.
That's quite true. Two points. First, the Class Action Fairness Act dispenses with the requirement of complete diversity. It makes quite clear that so long as there is minimal diversity, so long as any plaintiff is a citizen of a state that is a different state from any defendant's place of residence, then so long as the other criteria governing jurisdiction under CAFA are present, then the courts will have jurisdiction over it. And the Supreme Court, you know, has made clear that the diversity clauses themselves do not require complete diversity, that it is within Congress's discretion to vest jurisdiction in the courts on the basis of minimal diversity. They have, however, you know, I think erroneously, and the court itself, as I mentioned earlier, has determined that its early decision requiring complete diversity was in error. They have nonetheless insisted on complete diversity. And that is one of the things that's given rise to the reality that in very large tort actions and mass tort actions in this country, the asbestos cases that are, for example, are an excellent case in point of cases that involve parties of diverse citizenship, but the plaintiffs invariably find a local defendant to sue to ensure that complete diversity is destroyed, and that therefore cases are not removable from state court to federal court. That is a common practice. And one that, you know, we and one of the organizations that we represented in connection with this amicus brief, in particular, the Access to Courts Initiative, is determined to attempt to bring about reform on, because it has denied in countless cases that are plainly within the language and the purpose of the diversity clauses of the Constitution, is nonetheless denied interstate commercial enterprises what we believe is their constitutional right to a federal forum. So the caller's making a very good point.
Yeah, following up on from the other side, a suit against defendants, all of whom were within the same state, could conceivably have one of those defendants join an out-of-state defendant for no other purpose than to drive it into the realm of diversity and therefore permit removal. So lots of opportunities for abuse there.
Yeah, I guess there's opportunities on both sides of the V under, you know, certain circumstances. I don't think we have a whole lot of historical precedent of situations, at least that I'm aware of, where defendants have stepped up to try to become a defendant in a tort case or any other kind of case in order to try to destroy complete diversity, but it's certainly theoretically possible.
Well, in some states, a party can join another party without its consent.
Indeed.
Well, very good, gentlemen. We've exhausted the questions from the audience, but let me revert to you once again, Chuck Cooper and Howard Nielsen, and see if you want to express any final thoughts here before we conclude the call.
Dean, again, I want to thank you and the Federalist Society for setting up and hosting this call. We appreciate it very much. I hope that those who have dialed into the call have thought it worthwhile. Certainly we have. And I would just conclude by saying that we do think that the case now pending before the Supreme Court will give it an opportunity to hopefully re-examine the premises of some of its own jurisprudence relating to diversity jurisdiction, and that at a minimum, as my colleague Howard has put it earlier in the call, will not really aggravate what we think is inconsistency with the true original meaning of the diversity clauses by embracing any kind of interpretive canon that would resist the notion of removal in a case in which the parties are genuinely diverse, even if only minimally diverse, and hopefully begin a process, slow and gradual, to ultimately restoring at least as nearly as possible what the genuine original meaning of those provisions were. So thank you again very much, Dean, for hosting our call this afternoon.
Of course, we're very happy to do it. And this case, again, is scheduled for oral argument November 6th in the Supreme Court. I don't know if you're attending the oral argument, Chuck or Howard, but if you think it warrants it, we'd welcome you back after the oral argument for a report on how you think things went, and then, you know, maybe even again after a decision, you know, if you think it's momentous enough to warrant yet another call. But I want to take the opportunity to thank you both for joining us today. I think this has been a very interesting discussion to our audience. Thank you for dialing in. Thank you for your questions. I encourage you to join us for our next scheduled teleforum call next Wednesday, as we'll be speaking with FTC Commissioner Maureen Olhausen. But I'd also advise you to check our website for other teleforums that might just pop up between now and then. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.